So it's my privilege to open this conference and have to begin by thanking the organizers, especially Gerald and Mehtap for inviting me. And I guess my role here, I'm going to tell you a little bit about cosmology and begin by saying that there's some very big problems we don't understand. And since this room is full of very smart people, I'm hoping very much to persuade some of you to take an interest and help us out. So I'm going to be describing semi-classical gravity. It's an old subject, a really fascinating subject, and one to which we have applied some of these new methods, like Picard-Lefschetz theory. And quantum de Sitter, again, a very old, long-standing problem. How do you describe de Sitter space? This is work with my student, Job Feldbrugger, and then Jean-Luc Lehners, who's at the Albert Einstein Institute in Germany, and his student, Alice de Tucci. So here's the universe. We sit in the middle, obviously, of the region we can see. But we also sit in the middle in various other ways. We sit in the middle in scales, between the Planck scale and the dark energy scale. And the intriguing thing we've learned in the last couple of decades is the astonishing simplicity of the universe. There are just five numbers which describe its timeless aspect. You can parameterize today in various ways. But if you talk about the energy composition of the universe, we have baryons, we have dark matter, and dark energy as the dominant component, so that's three numbers. And then the geometry is stunningly simple. One amplitude for the scale invariant fluctuations, which came out of the Big Bang, and that's an amazing thing, that they were scale invariant, and then a very slight tilt. So to first approximation, one number describes the geometry of the universe on large scales. Of course, I've left out some fine details, like the masses of neutrinos, but there are lots of parameters which are consistent with zero. Many, many parameters, which we don't understand why they are so, like the three-point functions, the four-point functions of the primordial fluctuations, and the tensor to scalar ratio, which famously caused a big stir a few years ago, but is so far consistent with zero. Nature has apparently found a way to create a huge hierarchy of scales much more economically than any current theory. Any theory which explains this data involves at least one free function, and in some cases, astronomical numbers of free functions. So I would say we're doing a very poor job in explaining nature. This is a fascinating situation demanding new ideas. One of the most minimal of these is to revisit quantum cosmology, and the simplest of all quantum cosmologies is de Sitter. It's interesting both for today's dark energy, which says we're going into a de Sitter phase, and also for the theory of inflation, which I'm not a big fan of, but many people are, and I will say some words relevant to that too. So this is a series of papers in which we've returned to quantum cosmology to try to understand the fundamentals, and I'm going to tell you about the progress we've made. So the starting point is a very, very beautiful idea pioneered by John Wheeler and others called quantum geometrodynamics. The idea is you take an initial three geometry and you compute the quantum mechanical amplitude to obtain a final three geometry. And I'll label initial by zero and final by one. And you do so by summing over all intermediate four geometries, which have these two geometries as their boundary. And the fundamental object in the theory is the Feynman propagator for this amplitude. And amazingly, there's still some uncertainty about exactly what this means, but we will provide a definition and we will show that it is calculable. The basic object is going to be a phase space Lorentzian path integral. I'll explain why. There's a famous decomposition of a four geometry into three plus one, And so formally, one writes down a path integral as follows. You integrate over the lapse function. This parameter t will essentially just be a coordinate which goes from 0 to 1. So the proper time between those two surfaces is parameterized by the lapse. Then there's something called a shift, and then the 3 metric and its canonical momentum. So this is the object of interest. And I think the development of the theory sort of reached a pinnacle in the early 80s with the work of Claudio Teitelbaum, whose name changed to Bunster, who wrote some beautiful papers on this topic, working out many of the formal and conceptual aspects just before inflation came on the scene. And unfortunately, somehow what happened is this beautiful work was then ignored for about 30 years. And I'll explain a little bit why that happened and why theorists sort of went in a different direction. This is a comment about this theory of quantum geometrodynamics by one of its inventors, Bryce DeWitt. The most impressive fact that emerges is extraordinarily economical theory. And then he goes on, when the two theories are united, the result is an operational theory par excellence. And this means it's very conceptually challenging. You don't have time, you don't have all the obvious things you're used to relying on, it's a closed system, what does quantum mechanics mean, and so on. So they're very profound conceptual issues, meaning such basic questions as what is the probability is still not satisfactorily answered. But it seems that much of the work in the 70s and 80s, as I said, was kind of ignored. One of the subsequently, some very basic points, for example, in the causal propagator, the Feynman propagator, obtained by integrating over positive lapse only, allows you to distinguish an expanding from a contracting universe. You see, you label the initial three geometry as zero, and the final one as one, and on the left is an expanding universe. Whereas if the initial one is bigger than the final one, you have a contracting universe. So these two possibilities are allowed in the theory. Now, as I mentioned, to some extent, the subject veered away from this because of the theory of inflation and many people's desire to provide a theory of initial conditions for inflation. And this is the preeminent proposal, the Hartle-Hawking proposal, for the wave function of the universe. And so my first target will be to try to develop this idea. So let me give you a quote from this paper. One can interpret the functional integral over all compact four geometries bounded by a given three geometry. You see, they want to just have one three geometry and nothing, and only four geometry before it. They want a one-point function for a three geometry. The amplitude for that three geometry to arise from a zero three geometry, i.e. a single point. In other words, the ground state is the amplitude for the universe to appear from nothing. We should elaborate on this and so on. And then it refers to work by Vilenkin, who had similar ideas. In fact, Hartle and Hawking framed their proposal in terms of the Euclidean path integral, and I'll explain in a moment why this does not work semi-classically. But Vilenkin framed his entirely in terms of the Lorentzian path integral, which as I will show, does in a sense work. It gives a definite answer, but unfortunately not a very nice answer. There are lots of earlier versions, Lemaître, Fomin, Tryon, Braut, Englert, Gunzig. Many people have thought of this idea of creating the universe from nothing. Let's see, I thought I had a picture. Yep. There's even a popular book, a bestseller, called The Universe from Nothing, which I was going to show you a picture of, but it's disappeared into nothing. So here's the no boundary proposal. Three geometry of zero size, and then the universe emerges, and you try to calculate the amplitude for the final three geometry. I want to emphasize what a beautiful idea this is. The idea is that the laws of physics determine their own initial conditions. And one hopes that the emergence of time and the second law of thermodynamics and all these other profound questions would be addressed by such proposals. Oops. So as I said, the simplest model you can think of is just Einstein gravity with a cosmological constant. I'll always choose units in which 8 pi g is 1, and generally h bar and c are 1, except when they're useful to look at. So the action is just the Einstein-Hilbert action with a cosmological constant. And I'll take lambda to be positive mostly in this talk. The usual claim, and this was Hartle and Hawking and their collaborators' claim, is that the amplitude one obtains from this path integral is e to the plus 1 over h bar lambda for positive lambda, and then minus a spectrum of perturbations. These h's are the tensor gravitational wave perturbations on the final 3 geometry, and they come in a Gaussian form, so like a free quantum field in this background. Our claim is that when you calculate this path integral properly, the Lorentzian version, in fact there's only one change, which is the sign, and this sign changes, so you get e to the minus 1 over lambda. And unfortunately this has the effect of changing the perturbations from a Gaussian distribution to an inverse Gaussian distribution, which is just an absolute and total disaster. Okay, so I could actually just end my talk there and refer you to our papers. The rest is just mathematics, but I will try now to explain. So this is the picture. The perturbations are completely out of control. Our claim is there is no meaningful one-point amplitude for a 3.3 geometry, and I'll give you an argument later that shows that nothing is stable. Nothing, the state of nothing, i.e. no geometry, seems to be stable. There's some overlap with previous work. Vilenkin studied the background. He claimed this result, the e to the minus, but didn't study the perturbations. Rubikov studied the perturbations, from a different point of view, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. And I'm not really going to talk much about it, but if there's questions, I'm happy to answer. Wheeler-DeWitt equation has a lot more arbitrariness. It's an infinite dimensional differential equation with an infinite number of solutions. The path integral, in contrast, although it's very formal, is in principle unique. Ambjorn and Yol and Lowell studied the background. Again, they claim the minus. Sorkin also the background. Again, they claim the minus. I do think our work is the most complete and comprehensive to date. So we evaluate the Lorentzian path integral carefully using cosmological perturbation theory. We just treat the background, we do the perturbations, we know this works. Observationally, it's what we use with great success to explain the structure of the universe. And then we use Picard-Lefschetz and Cauchy's theorem to determine the relevant saddle points. So the procedure is to write down this path integral, first to integrate out the background, the zero mode, then the fluctuations, and finally this lapse n. Okay, so very little attention has been paid to the integral over the lapse in previous work. But all it's saying is that the size of this 4 geometry in between the 2, 3 geometries really is a variable that needs to be integrated over in semi-classical quantum gravity. And all the interesting effects I'll talk about come from that integral. So here's the background, just Friedman-Robertson-Walker. This is the familiar action with the lambda. I'm going to take a closed model, so spherical geometry, three sphere. And then we'll do some redefinitions, so redefining the lapse, redefining the scale factor squared as a variable q, we find that we have a quadratic action. So the functional integral over q is a Gaussian. I'm going to ignore the Jacobian, which comes from the change of variables, because that's not at the same order in h-bar. That's lower order in h-bar. So we just get a quadratic in q, and even a cosmologist can evaluate a Gaussian integral. Okay, so here's what the metric looks like. And then one has to solve the classical equations given the at t equals zero, the size of the universe is zero, the three geometry is zero, t equals one, it's q1, and here's the solution, just t squared plus t with some constants. And now you evaluate the classical action, and here it is. So if I had no perturbations on the final three geometry, this would be the correct answer for the classical action, and I have to do this integral over n. So here it is, I'm left with this integral over n. I'm going to concentrate on the Feynman path integral, which goes from 0 plus to infinity, and I've got this oscillation in the phase. So we know from Picard-Lefschetz theory there's nothing to be scared of in oscillatory integrals. They're perfectly well-defined, and the way to make them well-defined, so they're initially defined along the real axis. This is the Lorentzian, strictly Lorentzian path integral. N is real and positive, and this integral does converge, even though only conditionally. You can make the integral absolutely convergent by deforming the contour into the complex plane, and when you do this, you try and deform it to a contour running through a saddle point, a steepest descent contour running through saddle point, and that means it's absolutely convergent. So I think most of you in the room know about Picard-Lefschetz theory. I won't really summarize it. It's just a nice way of discovering which saddle points are relevant or irrelevant to any particular contour integral. So in this case, the contour is clear, and the relevant saddle point is clear. There are other saddle points which are clearly irrelevant. So a little bit of notation. The J is the steepest descent contour. The K is the steepest ascent contour. And Picard-Lefschetz theory tells you that a saddle point is relevant if and only if the steepest ascent contour from that saddle encounters the contour, the defining contour of integration. Okay, so that's a very beautiful and useful fact, which in principle works in many dimensions. So this is the relevant saddle point. Unfortunately, Hartle and Hawking saddle point is the other one. And in fact, there's a very straightforward argument that you can never get a positive exponent in a semi-classical calculation of a Lorentzian path integral, precisely because you must always go up from the relevant saddle point to the original contour. On the original contour, we're just integrating a phase, so the modulus is 1. So any answer has to be less than 1, so that immediately rules out the claimed result. This is the Feynman propagator. You can also integrate from minus infinity to infinity along the real axis, and since there is an essential singularity at n equals zero coming from this term, just the usual term in quantum mechanics, we always get a one over time singularity in the exponent coming from the kinetic term. One can avoid that just by deforming the contour above, and the half line integral gives you the Feynman propagator. The Hamiltonian acting on it gives you a delta function, because there's a surface term associated with this essential singularity. But you can equally just take the real part of the Feynman propagator, and that will now solve the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So it's trivial to start from the Feynman propagator, take its real part, and voila, you have a solution of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, if you want one. I'm not saying you want one, but, and as I mentioned, there's a lot of redundancy in the Wheeler-DeWitt equations, and many, many solutions. This is one of them. It's not the one which Hartle and Hawking wanted. There are many basic issues with the Euclidean path integral, but one of these seems not to have been discussed in the literature, and it's really so trivial that we felt we had to raise it. So you do a Wick rotation of n. Remember, the coordinates t and x are just coordinates. You have no business deforming those into the complex plane when you're doing gravity. The integral is over the metric. It's not over the coordinates, the path integral. So if you're going to do any Picard-Lefschetz theory, it's over the metric, and the dynamical variables, not the coordinates. So t always goes from 0 to 1, but n can be rotated. The exponent is then real, but of course it's an odd function of the Euclidean lapse. I mean, that's why this works, that's why IS becomes real. So semi-classically, the integral over this diverges in any d. Exponential of an odd function, if I try to integrate over all n, obviously will diverge at one end or the other. So your only option is to integrate over a half line, 0 to infinity if you're doing Euclidean, but then you don't get a wave function of the universe. You don't get a solution of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation because there's also always a delta function. So somehow at a very basic level, this really doesn't work semi-classically. Furthermore, in four dimensions, it turns out the divergences at 0 and at infinity, so you see this diverges at 0 and at infinity, but they have the opposite sign. That tells you there's no half interval you can integrate over and get a finite answer. The only case is if Q1 is 0, and I'll come to that later. So this is another problem with the Euclidean path integral. Therefore, we'll stick to the Lorentzian one, which doesn't have these problems, and study the perturbations. So we take our background metric and we add tensor perturbations at quadratic order. And in principle, there's no problem with doing perturbation theory to higher order, and in our papers we do that numerically. So the quadratic action looks something like this. Now notice it. Notice that the kinetic term of the gravitational wave has a problem near q equals 0, right? Q equals 0 is the no boundary, right? It's the initial geometry. So that is potentially a problem. At q equals 0, this equation is potentially singular. So we redefine it to canonically normalize, and you get some equation like this, just a Schrödinger equation in a 1 over t squared potential, where the strength of the singularity is controlled by a quantity gamma, which depends on the mode number. This L is the mode number on the three sphere. Depends on the mode number and Q1 and so on. So one can show that the real part of gamma is positive everywhere in the complex n-plane, and except on a branch cut. And this ensures finite action. So that's kind of a nice thing and also a slightly disturbing thing, that when I integrate out the perturbations and I look in this complex X n plane, first let me just emphasize there is no problem on the Picard-Lefschetz thimble at all. There is a problem, and there's no problem at the saddle points. There is a problem at off-shell values of the lapse on the real axis, and I'll explain why. So what this is telling you, you see, when you apply Picard, it tells you a couple of things. First of all, if you do Picard-Lefschetz theory for finite dimensional integrals, you are guaranteed never to get branch cuts in the action, okay, providing your original action was holomorphic. You never get branch cuts in the action. This happens because this is an infinite dimensional problem, and as those of you who know the inverse square potential, you know that beyond a critical value of gamma, you can get, when this coefficient is negative, you can get oscillations, infinite number of oscillations, and so the quantum mechanics becomes tricky, and that's responsible for the branch cut. So infinite dimensional integrations, partial integrations, generate branch cuts even in the exponent. And this branch cut,